Can I ask, Noah, is that a Nuka-Cola t-shirt?
Yeah, it sure is, actually. I actually found it in Goodwill the day after I finished watching the show, which I thought was auspicious, so I thought I'd throw it on.
That is so wonderful. Yeah, and that couldn't be more auspicious, I guess.
I'm really stoked to, like, be talking with you guys about this. Like, I love the show quite a bit, and, like, Fallout truly, truly is my favorite, like, video game franchise. Like, it's very exciting for me to be here today.
It's mine as well. I really love it. I thought just for the audience, and Jason, I'm sorry, but full spoilers for everything. TV show, all the games. So, Jason, if you need to flee, do it now.
No. I'm in here for the long haul. I'll take it as it comes.
Noah, thank you so much for coming on. We've been toying with the idea of doing like a longer Fallout thing for a long time. Obviously, we have our outro credits has Ron Perlman saying the line in them that's kind of mixed into a bit of music. I would say that as like a reporter that's covered nuclear issues, Fallout's very important to me, has been very important to me for a long time. I think has important things to actually say about America and nostalgia and nuclear weapons. And hot damn, never in a million years did I think that they would make a TV show that was that good.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what to expect, but I wasn't expecting them to nail the tone of, like, freewheeling absurdism quite as well as it did. Like, the show thrives on the exact same kind of, like, bitter, dark irony that, like, the games do.
The best games do, anyway. Yeah. Not all of them have that tone. Right.
Can we introduce Noah?
Yes. Sorry, I'm bad at that. Noah, will you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
My name is Noah Caldwell-Gervais. I'm a YouTuber and a video essayist. So I do longer YouTube videos that are essentially just nonfiction adapted into a more visual format. So it starts with the essay, and then the game footage gets layered on top, and that way it can facilitate like sort of longer discussions than like a traditional outlet would be willing to pay for, and sort of more in-depth discussions than a Let's Play format or like a more casual seat of the pants kind of deal.
Yeah, I thought about you for this after watching the 9-hour kind of redo, because one of your first videos was about Fallout, right? It was like a retrospective of the entire series.
The very first one that I did, actually, yeah. So I had no idea what I was doing, and like I used Windows Movie Maker and recorded on a microphone from Radio Shack, and so it was in 480p and looked like it had been shook around inside of a garbage can and sounded like it too. Like it had needed remaking for a long time.
This thing, audience, is comprehensive and does an incredible job of going through the entire franchise and laying out what works and what doesn't, what's good about Fallout. And when I say the entire franchise, I mean we're doing Brotherhood of Steel, we're doing Fallout Tactics, we're doing Fallout Shelter, everything. I also really love it's divided into two videos, the ones where you're going across the country and you're giving tours of the real life locations that inspired Fallout locations is also a really incredible video series.
That's one of my favorite things that I've ever done. Like it's really funny actually, because like I have a really sort of back and forth symbiotic relationship between games writing and travel writing. Like when I was a kid, like I was really, really inspired by travel writing because I loved sci-fi and fantasy, but like those worlds don't actually exist. But like if you read William Lee Steve Moon's Blue Highways, you know, all of those things are true and all of his experiences are real. And so like the idea that like you could have like real adventure and make something contextually meaningful out of the journey and like, you know, throw together history and anecdote and sort of like the way Bill Bryson does it. Like that was really, really influential on me as a kid. So then like after the channel took off and I got enough money to actually like sort of reverse it, and instead of travel writing influencing the games writing, to do games writing influencing my travel writing, like that was a really exciting, really cool moment. And like one of my favorite projects that I've ever gotten a chance to do. Like that was like doing a travelogue is exponentially more expensive than doing a video game video and much more difficult, but like that's why they're rare. Like I feel like I did something really special with those.
Your video about the history of the transcontinental highway system, while you travel it, helped get me through COVID.
Oh,
by the way, like I got it. Yeah, I got it like the week when that video came out. So all I could do really was lay on the couch. And it was very helpful to have that, to be able to watch that and engage my brain a little bit as I coughed and slowly felt like I was dying. But let's talk more about Fallout.
Yeah.
Should we tell, like, actually do a premise, or are we expecting that everybody is, like,
these are,
you know, familiar with the game?
This one's just for the paying. This one's for the paying people and the people that asked us to do it. You know, all of the, thanks to the TV show, all the games are like 75% off right now, and there's banners on every game service. So
absolutely, but, yeah.
But okay, fair. You like to do table setting. You like to be a professional. No, will you give us like the elevator pitch for the Fallout franchise?
Elevator pitch for the Fallout franchise. If you take the mood of the early Cold War era, the duck and cover era that sort of came out of the World War II optimism, and that tension between like the imminent and potential destruction of the entire world and the absolute extravaganza of consumerism that were both going on in the early 50s. You take that vibe and then you move it conceptually 100 years into the future, where nothing socially has really changed, but we also have lasers. And you also like take that world that feels familiar, but now because we've introduced sci-fi elements, it isn't exactly. Then you destroy it and you layer on like all of these post-apocalyptic tropes that have been like so classic ever since, you know, media started considering, well, what would happen if the end of the world ended? So there's all sorts of influences in there that are classic from like the Twilight Zone episode where like the nuclear war happens and the fella like who's a misanthrope breaks his glasses and that's the end of his good times and his empty world that's only him now. Like that's so old as far as like how we think about nuclear war now. But there's a consistency and a through line as to like what are the emotions around apocalypse, like what is the aesthetic of apocalypse, and like there's sort of an Americanism in post-apocalyptic media that Fallout really embraces. Like the duck and cover era was so unique and so strange, and I think, like, to modern eyes, it seems like a very silly and naive era, which it kind of is, but, like, maybe we've just sort of gotten used to the apocalypse to the point that where the idea of, like, this looming over us being new just doesn't, like, rate anymore. Like, it's interesting because Fallout sort of, like, reconnects us to that time where, like, the idea of apocalypse was just as strange and freewheeling and anything goes as anything else.
This is one of the reasons that I really connected with it when I did, like, as a young man, because I felt like it helped me understand my parents, because they lived with that in a way that I did not. I was born in 1983. Like, we have Abel Archer, and then things kind of really start to calm down. And by the time I understood what was possible with nuclear weapons, it felt like the threat was over. Obviously, we live in a much different world now. But, you know, finding those Fallout games and seeing that reflection of that anxiety and that the architecture and seeing kind of the world of the future perverted.
Yeah.
It really helped me kind of understand my parents' fears and anxieties. And that's really one of the reasons that I connected with, especially like 1 and 2 early on.
Yeah. No, 1 and 2 were more interactive with the anxiety of it than the absurdity of it.
Yes.
Well, Fallout 2, plenty absurd anyway. I was born in 88, so after you, so like I have even fewer actual memories of the Cold War. Like when did the Berlin Wall fall? I must have been like,
okay, this is just not right. First of all, okay, I was born in 71. It fell in 89.
I was waiting for you to chime in.
Yeah. I'll just sit here and shut up now. But
no,
I am. Damn young whippersnapper. Blah, blah,
blah, blah. Well, I am curious about like the history of, you know, somebody born in 71, the history of your nuclear anxiety, such as it was. And then when did you find fallout?
So that for me, nuclear anxiety was the kind of thing that kept me up at night, and I wasn't the only one. I actually did have one duck and cover drill in my elementary school. I actually had to get down under a desk, which is so ridiculous when you think about it. I have no idea what that desk was about to do for me. Yeah, it was so real, so present. All the time. Fallout, I think, actually let me play with those fears too. I mean, it reminded me of like, actually in some ways I have a more optimistic view of it, which is, this is going to sound probably pretty silly, but, Fallout, some version of the world survives. I mean, you know, as opposed to absolutely everybody being dead, it's just like Monty Python once said, mostly dead.
Yes, I really agree with that. I mean, there's a huge tone difference between Fallout and like McCarthy's The Road. Like The Road is like truly, truly one of the bleakest and most emotionally affecting pieces of post-apocalyptic media I've ever read or seen. Like the film version is so beautiful also. But like it postulates a world that has truly died, but Fallout does not.
Yeah, it's a new world. It's a brave new world. And actually, in some sense, the optimism of the old world that's been destroyed kind of carries through, I think, a little bit. And I mean, just because it makes you laugh, the bobbleheads and the videos that, you know, you break into and that are just like those, you know, videos from the 50s. They're just so, you know, the instructional videos. Right? I mean, just so much of that embedded in the games that you're actually laughing your way through the apocalypse and the wasteland, you know? It's a very weird thing.
The soundtrack carries a lot of that, definitely. Like, the really bright Poppy's 40s 50s tracks that they play just underline it completely. And like, I shit on Fallout 3 a lot, and it's not my favorite game, but like, they more than Fallout 1 and 2 really united the world and that era of music through like their radio selections and Three Dog the DJ. like, I'm pretty sure in the show they brought back the track Let's Go Sunnin'. And like that one is just like so perfect, just the way that the lead singer like delivers that, like pretty flowers need the sun, and this applies to everyone. Like, you know, everyone just needs to be happy and everything's gonna be fine and don't even worry about it. And like the contrast between like that attitude and like the world itself, and like the whole character of Lucy in the show like operates on that contrast, right? Of her okie doke optimism and then everything that she has to goddamn do out in the wasteland.
She's such a perfect protagonist for a television show. Really just incredible. Like, I can't stop thinking about, as a fan of like the entire franchise, you start watching that show and I get a couple episodes in and I'm like, oh, the people who made this have played all of the games. I'm getting like obviously there's a really huge attention to visual detail that comes from the Bethesda stuff, right? And they obviously worked very closely with Bethesda to make a lot of that happen. But so much of the tone and the attitude and the lore, which we'll get into a little bit later, is like, oh, this is like we're talking about Fallout 1 and 2 stuff here. And it is really, it's really typified in Lucy, who is this vault dweller, Jason, who has to go out into the wasteland and chase a MacGuffin, typical Fallout. And she's got, they cast Ella Purnell, who's got these giant naive eyes. And she has like a very 1950s, attitude towards everything and is like really game for anything and believes in the golden rule and then goes up into the wasteland and has to interact with it and still try to retain that sensibility as she pushes through increasingly terrible scenarios. So 3, I assume, was the first one you played, Jason?
Yeah, you're right. I went back and, played around with the others, but yeah, I really fell in love with 3.
And you live in DC now.
Yeah, which I didn't at the time. But now I just go, wow, you know. And it makes sense that Bethesda would, I mean, because they actually were, I don't know if they still are, based in Bethesda,
which they is are,
right
yeah.
outside They're DC, still there. Right? Still there. So, I mean, they know the district. They know the area down cold. And it's really interesting to just put those memories together with what I drive around every day.
I think I would say that that is one of the strengths of the ones that Bethesda has developed, is their ability to capture real-life places and then turn them into a post-nuclear nightmare world is really impressive. I think especially 3 and 76.
When I went to Boston to do the real life landscapes of Fallout for the East Coast one, so I did 76 and 4 and 3 at sort of the same time in the same 2-week period. And the way that they shrunk the downtown to scale in Fallout 4 is really wild. Like the pedestrian experience of like walking from one end of downtown to another end. Like I took one day where I went from like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and I did like 14 total miles of just like walking around the city. And it felt incredibly consistent with the sort of distances and the sort of impression of a distance that I had from Fallout 4. Like it's definitely more obvious when they get the big landscape going, when for like Fallout 76 or Fallout 3. But Fallout 4, even though it has like a thinner urban focus, is actually like equally, if not more skilled at doing that act of sort of translation between an actual place and a video game.
The beauty of 4 to me will always be going to the top of one of the skyscrapers downtown and stepping outside and being up and seeing the whole landscape before me and the sound design, like the creaking and the wind.
Yeah.
Just an incredible feeling that they've built. So I want to backtrack here a little bit. Can you give me what was your first Fallout, Noah?
Fallout 1. I got a CD version of Fallout 1 when I was 12, and I had like kind of a weird, complicated, unpleasant home life at the time. So it was the first like adult role-playing game I'd played, like adult in that it assumes that you want to make heavy choices and that there's like consequence behind what you do, like a game that like treats you, the player, as an adult. And like that was an incredible revelation for me because I felt like very small and very powerless in my own life. And so in this game, like I could not only like project onto this other character, like I could build them out and build out their personality in a way that was really, that felt personal. Like going back to Fallout 1, a lot of the quests are sort of binary in how you're able to solve them. And there aren't nearly as many quests as the later games, but like even still within that more limited format, like the feeling of personal freedom and player self-determination was really powerful to me. And that's sort of like, as much as the setting, what got me into it.
At 12, did you have much sense of like the nuclear anxiety aspect, or was that all just kind of background stuff?
Well, I was raised by old people. So like I was adopted, but it was an open adoption. So my adopted parents were like in their late 40s, early 50s, like when I was born. So they had all sorts of things around the house, like older appliances. They had like all of these globes that were still labeled with the Soviet Union. So like I grew up surrounded by like artifacts of this time that like other kids didn't have in their homes. And so Fallout in a certain way like made me make better sense of sort of like the depth of time and like the difference in time between generations, because like my parents were sort of like one generation down the line from like most other kids in my school.
I just want to say that I have a globe from my dad, and it actually has Siam.
Oh, wow.
And Persia and Africa without a single independent nation. They're all colonies. And yeah, as far as I can figure out, it's not dated, but I think it's 37.
Wow.
Anyway, it's one of my treasured possessions. So anyway, sorry to break in with that. But
no, not at all.
No, I think that's there's something about this franchise in particular that helps connect people to like a weird imagined, a weird American past that didn't happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was this dream of the 50s in the 60s that gets leaned on in this country that didn't actually exist. And Fallout supposes that it did, and it went on for 100 years. Yeah. And then at the end of that dream, America started resource wars to keep that dream going.
Yeah. And
it went really bad for the world.
That's one of my favorite cynicisms of the early titles, is the idea that the consumerism was always unsustainable. It just took a whole century for it to get to its like terminal point.
In what ways would society twist in that 100 years, right?
Yeah.
I thought I also, one other thing that's really interesting about it is when you're talking about resources, they don't ever come up with the transistor. You're still using, like vacuum tubes and nuclear power. They've really miniaturized nuclear power all over the place. It's pretty wonderful for that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they never miniaturized electronics at all.
I love that bulky look, though. Like the sound of that older technology is really something, too. Like the sound of vacuum tubes warming up is just something that you could never get in a digital age. Like there's so many like markers of physical analog technology that like I miss. Like growing up with like CRT televisions and hearing like the clunk and then the fade in while the tubes were warming up. Like having that in radio with vacuum tube radios. Like I was such a Fallout fan that like I one of my first purchases for a home apartment when I turned 18 and moved out on my own was to get a tube radio off eBay. Like I was obsessed. I wanted one. I needed one.
There's that hum you don't get. Right. That's at the, isn't that the beginning of 3, or maybe it was the trailer when the announcement.
It's the intro too, the bus radio that pans out into the broken street.
So what do you think of the show?
I loved it. the way that they deliberately, from interviews that I've read, wove different player approaches and sort of player narratives into the three primary characters that they focus on, makes it feel sort of much more rowdy and much more like true to the experience of the games than like I expected if they were going to focus on like a single character. Because like in choosing three such very different protagonists, they've like abandoned any kind of tidy tone control. It's very freewheeling. It's very absurdist. And like that feels very true to the games to me. Like there's the line that Walter Goggins has in like the second episode or maybe third, where he's like, well, that's the rule of the wasteland. Thou shalt always get sidetracked by bullshit every damn time. And like that is The rule, if there's going to be one rule for the Fallout TV show, it has to be that thou must get sidetracked by bullshit every damn time. And, like, they did it, to their credit. They did it that way. Like, when I saw the Last of Us TV show, like, there was, I think, their second episode. Like, they do a lot of video game traversal stuff. Like, Joel and Ellie are, like, moving through this hotel and doing the thing where, like, all right, well, I've got to lift you up here and you unlock the door from behind. And, like, that was interesting to see and, like, definitely made it feel more in keeping with the game to, like, retain that kind of stuff that might be, like, otherwise, like, overlooked in a traditional, like, linear passive media narrative. But, like, Fallout the TV show isn't playing for, like, stakes that are so low. They're going real wild with it and, like just throwing all sorts of shit at the wall and seeing what sticks. And, like, a lot of it is sticking for me. I've been enjoying the hell out of it.
On that note, I really loved the Brotherhood of Steel being this kind of stand-in for the run-and-gun, not really paying attention to the story, just want to shoot something kind of player experience of a Fallout game.
Yeah. Maximus is a fun character. Like, it took me a while to really sort of warm up to him. But there's definitely a feeling going through a lot of times of not being sure what the right answer is and not wanting to make a mistake and just trying to do whatever it is that is, like, best for your own self-preservation at a given moment. And, like, that attitude in Maximus is very enjoyable. Like, his incompetence and his naivete is, like, in a certain way, like, can be a little irritating, but, like, it comes from a place, I think, of real sympathy for, like, how difficult it can be to actually find a place in these games world, in these game worlds. Like, it Walter Goggins' character has been out there for 200 years. He's had plenty of time. Like, Maximus is, like, the character is, like, what, 20 at most, something around there?
Something like that, because he was probably, what, five, somewhere between 5 and 8?
Yeah.
In those flashbacks that we see of Shady Sands?
Yeah.
The Goggins character is, because you've basically got, like, a new person in Lucy who is open to the experience and wants to roleplay, like, has a high speech, has some charisma. Maximus, who's from the faction that just wants to shoot stuff. More so Michael Rapaport, who gets eaten very quickly. which is, like, really amusing stunt casting. Because Jason, he's a Brotherhood of Steel in the giant T-60, like, power armor. And Maximus is, like, his squire, and they're going out into the wasteland. And Michael Rapaport, you don't see him. He's in all this armor. He's got, like, a voice filter. He stops the Whirlybird and he's like, let us out. I'm bored. I want to shoot something. And they go down and they fight a bear. And Michael Rapaport gets absolutely just destroyed and is screaming obscenities and gets dragged off by this bear. And they take off his helmet and there's Michael Rapaport under it. I'm like, oh, okay. That makes sense.
I gotta say, the first second I saw that power armor, I had to have it. I had to have a suit of that. And if I could give up one of my children for a suit of that armor right now, right here in the real world, I probably would have to take that bargain.
That's funny. Like, the iconography of the power armor is something that, like, sometimes irritates me with the Fallout franchise, because, like, I feel like the focus on power armor sometimes draws focus from sort of the thematic role it had in the first couple of games as being, like, this techno-medievalist kind of thing that sort of shows the corruption of the old world by, like, going back to these things. And I think, like, the way the show handles the Brotherhood is very much in keeping with that. But, like, I was really worried about, like, too much fan service with the power armor. And, like, when they first introduced it and someone's like, whoa, is that the T-60? My wife, who's watching it with me, turns to me and says, wow, baby, is that the T-60? Like, okay, fine. Yes, it's nerdy shit. Thanks for pointing that out. But, like, they don't just, like, keep it there on that level of, like, name recognition. Like, they actually do in the show, like, make it really interactive with the themes, like, through Walter Goggins' character, like, being like a veteran within the context of the franchise and like having been in Anchorage and being like, you know, the only reason that there is the T-60s is because a lot of good men died in the T-45s. It's like, that's that's interesting.
I like the idea of just being the safety as you wander around. And of course, the armor isn't really that great. I mean, it's good, but it's not that great. So, you know, I like, you know, just the concept of safety among all of the beasts and everything else. I think that's sort of what really grabbed me. But anyway, enough about me.
I like that they have Soviet tank naming conventions too. It's the T-45 and the T-60. And then Fallout 76, there's a whole bunch of like different pieces and names of all the different chunks of power armor, right? I can't.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't even begin to track it down. Like I know that the X designation is for the Fallout 2 style, like post-war enclave, armor, but like beyond that, I don't really know. Like Fallout 76's most iconic armor to me is the excavator suit because it gives you so much carry weight bonus. Like I never use anything else because I never want to give up the extra 150 pounds of inventory space.
You got to do that special quest. Was it like halfway through when you're going into the mole area for the first time?
Yeah.
This excavator suit. Yeah. I've played too much Fallout 76. So one thing I was thinking about, before the show had started, is this lovely concept that you introduced in your videos of the East Coast versus the West Coast fallouts. And we're firmly in an era of East Coast fallout, I think. But then this TV show comes along and I noticed that it was set in Los Angeles. And I was like, oh, okay. So this is in the era of big East Coast control over the Fallout franchise. Here comes something set on the West Coast. Can you tell me what East Coast versus West Coast fallout theory is?
Well, it's partly a theory. It's also partly just an observation of sort of development trends. So when Bethesda bought the rights to Fallout and started with Fallout 3 as sort of their own in-house vision of the franchise, like they set it on the East Coast, which differentiated it from Fallout 1 and 2, which had both been on the West Coast. And then that continued because Obsidian, the developer that like primarily made New Vegas, was mostly veterans from the former studios that had made Fallout 1 and 2. So sort of that group of people got to have their own canon and their own take on the games that Bethesda didn't really interfere with a huge amount. So Bethesda chose for their settings, like mostly all East Coast, which is why, like, when I had to visit them, I had to divide it into two videos because, like, you can't physically really travel conveniently between one set of games and the other. So the East Coast games are like Bethesda's general approach, much more simulational than narrative. Like you said, like, one of your more memorable moments in Fallout 4 was coming to the top of that skyscraper and like seeing the vista and listening to the wind and like the sound of the creaking metal. And like, that's what Fallout 3 and 4 truly, truly excel at, is creating a simulational environment that is deep enough to really facilitate that sense of personal exploration. But they're not really focused on narrative and factions and power structure and theme and like, well, what does it all mean and how does it all cohere? And the West Coast Fallouts do. Like Fallout 3, 4, and 76, none of them really end exactly. Like Fallout 3 did have an ending, but then it was patched out with the Broken Steel DLC. Like all of those games are designed to basically let you exist within that environment for as long as you want. And so there's a certain amount of narrative consequence that's limited by creating a space where a player can do that. Where New Vegas, once you do the last quest, it is over. You are not allowed back in the wasteland. Like your character is done. In the same way with Fallout 1 and 2, like all of those have epilogue slides that tell about, that sort of like wrap up your journey and take the decisions that you've made and like tell you like what happens to the wasteland in the future based off of those decisions. And that's always been like really, really powerful for me, because like it made me feel like what I did really mattered. Like in a way that I struggled with simulationally in Fallout 4. Like after Fallout 4 has ended, I just feel like I stopped because I was tired of the game, not like, oh, I had finished and here is my story and let me tell you about what I did. So like East Coast and West Coast Fallout is sort of historically a difference of developers and development houses. And then within that development, it's a difference between sort of a narrative focus and a simulational focus.
So then, I mean, I know this isn't fair because that's a television show and it's not game design. But using that rubric, what do you think, what does it tell you about the television show?
Well, it diminishes my hope for an Obsidian-led Fallout spinoff. It feels like Bethesda is sort of reclaiming the West Coast as its own and doing their own thing, which is, you know, they're right, absolutely. But Fallout 1 and 2 and New Vegas, like, all effectively form a trilogy where, like, the characters stack on top of each other and their actions stack on top of each other. And what happens to these factions in the various games over time is, like, cumulative. Like, the Brotherhood, as portrayed in New Vegas, is very much driven by the changes you saw them go through in Fallout 1 and Fallout 2. And same with the New California Republic. Like, the New California Republic only exists as a civilization because of what your player character does in Fallout 1, which is what's so interesting when you come back as, like, your player character's descendant for your next player character in Fallout 2. It's like, wow, this was a pretty big unintended consequence. And then the New California Republic's role in New Vegas is sort of like the, like, large traditional power structure invading from the West. Like, that's another consequence. Like, it stacks them and it layers them in an interesting way. And the show deciding that the New California Republic was too complicated of an organization to really continue to follow is kind of sad for me, because it breaks that accumulation. Like, it resets things. And in a certain way, that's understandable to me, because it's also a genre reset. Like, the more the NCR is allowed to grow as a traditional, like, civilization and a familiar civilization, the less post-apocalyptic it feels. Like, one of the endings for New Reno in Fallout 2, like, talks about, like, literacy rates and, like, the schools that come in, like, if the rights gain control but don't gain access to the weapons. So if they gain access to the weapons from the Sierra Army Depot, then they become just as bad as the other gangs. But if you destroy all the other gangs and don't let the rights, like, find their path to violence, then things actually become, like, pretty regular, pretty normal, like, really rather familiar in a, like, pre-war kind of way. So, like, the further you get into playing out the consequences of these decisions in the West Coast Fallouts, the further away you get from that original post-apocalyptic feel of Fallout 1. So I think the idea behind a lot of the major structural changes for the Fallout show is genre reset, to go back and sort of wipe out these things that feel like a frontier, and wipe out these things that feel like a real civilization, so that it can feel properly post-apocalyptic still, which is, like, in a certain way, you could call it kind of a stagnation, because, like, now we've looped back around to this earlier era. But as far as the storytelling and the mood is concerned, like, that earlier era is where the classic Fallout feeling is strongest.
This is why I get what you're saying, that there's this, that when you come to the end of New Vegas, depending on a bunch of your player choices, you are at the end of an era, right?
Yeah.
The frontier is being settled. Shady Sands has got, you know, 35,000 people. according to the television show. What's the gang of like a gang? Are they the Khans?
The Khans, yeah, and who are present in One and New Vegas.
The Khans are kind of settling down. This kind of this example that you have of like raider culture stopping, essentially. You know, again, depending on what kind of choices you make, the West is getting settled. Things are calming down. We live in this time now where when the Fallout games were originally coming out, and then up through like even 76, as late as 76, I would say, like the world's nuclear outlook was pretty good. We had all these treaties, things were being dismantled, the world was getting safer. It looked like we were going to this place where we were taking steps in the right direction. Now there's like one existing nuclear treaty between the United States and Russia, and it's probably going to go away in 2026. North Korea has nuclear weapons. Iran is probably going to have nuclear weapons. It feels like it's interesting to have a show that's set in this post-apocalyptic wasteland that I've been interacting with all of my adult life, that also has reset the nuclear order and gone back. Where like Vault-Tec dropped a bomb on Shady Sands, a nuclear bomb, presumably, and destroyed it. And the nuclear order has been reset and things are back to the bad place that they were in. And it feels like, and you know, this is my bias as someone who reports on these issues. It feels like we're there again. Like we've got Cold War levels of badness happening in geopolitics. And it's interesting to see them, you know, maybe not intentionally, but reflected in this television show. You know, you have to address the world of the show as separate from all of that. But I'm always interested in the way that art and reality are like in conversation with each other. So like that stuff really worked for me. Although I do hear you that it is a bit like Bethesda coming in and saying, like, this is what Fallout means. These are the visual signifiers of it. We can't have civilization going too far if we're going to keep selling that visual.
So. Well, that tension is even present within New Vegas, with the Lonesome Road DLC. Like, before they added context into the show in the last episode where they like revealed that it was Vault-Tec behind it, I assumed actually that they just made one of those DLC endings canon where the courier is the one that like did the nuking. Like, because I think one of the things that like irritates people about it is that when they first revealed that the NCR is just a hole in the ground now, you know, Lucy asks Maximus, like, oh, what happened? And Maximus is like, well, I guess people just don't get along. And like, that's just such a non-answer. It's enormously frustrating. And like, it takes all the way until the season finale where they actually add context back into it.
So you're going to get that. You're going to get that answer from Maximus, though.
Yeah. Right? No, you're going to get that answer from Maximus. It's just deeply unsatisfying.
Was it Goggins says in the last episode, there's always some new faction.
Yeah, I do really love the idea of Vault-Tec as like resurgent villain though. Like they're such a key part of the setting and like such a key part of the mood that like I enjoy the idea that if we're going to do a restructuring and sort of a recentering, that they should be the villainous part of things. Like, As far as modern nuclear anxiety goes, like one of my biggest nuclear anxieties is that like I no longer have 100% faith in the U.S. as like a rational actor on the world stage. Like the Trump years were so hard for everybody, and we're coming up on like another election, and like there's this idea that like there's this terrible power out there that is controlled primarily by the worst people you know. And that is such a huge anxiety for me. And it's an anxiety that I think the show addresses in this switch to Vault-Tec as like supreme villain.
Yeah, absolutely. That and kind of making them the primary antagonist, I think, really does work for me as well. And especially, like, we're all a little tired of capitalism right now. Like, making that kind of explicit, making them the face of that, is really fantastic. Do you think they dropped the bomb, the original bomb that started off the wars?
I think it's important not to ever definitively answer that question, but to just keep it sort of an accusatory froth. Like, I think that's what feels right and works well. But like, even if within the fiction of the setting, like, China launched first or the US launched first, like, that doesn't really matter. What matters is that Vault-Tec was meddling, and that, like, they had their, you know, if you think of it as like a one of those like cartoony dynamite plungers, like, they had their hand on it, and that's what matters.
Tim Kaine has said that it was China before, right? Like, and it's in one of his like off the cuff interviews somewhere.
I think, right? So, but like, I don't know if it is definitive, because like, Emil Paglio, what is his last name? I can't quite remember. He was one of the lead writers on Fallout 3, but he had a tweet where he was talking about how the default male character from Fallout 4 was like present in the Fallout 1 cutscene, that he was the guy waving in the background, and like, he wasn't prepared for people being like, oh, that's gross and weird, like, why would you say that? And
see, like,
he backtracked on it.
I was thinking of that message. He's like, people are weirdly, not people, gamer identitarians of the Fallout variety are weirdly obsessed with him. And it's funny, I think that if that is true, that the main protagonist of Fallout 4 is present in the background of that image waving at the camera as, you know, a war crime is committed in front of him, that makes that character much more interesting to me, personally.
It does, but, like, the thing is that, like, I don't think he was saying that because it was interesting for those reasons, or he wouldn't have backtracked on it. Like, if he was trying to create a dark parallel that way, then I don't think he would have been like, oh, but I didn't really mean it so dark as that. Because, like, on the face of it, that shit's dark, like, straight up. Like, there's just not a lot of way around that without either embracing it or backtracking.
That's totally fair. It does bring me to one of my other questions. So there is this kind of narrative amongst Fallout fans, especially amongst, like, old-school Fallout fans like you and I, that Bethesda are poor stewards, that they have screwed this franchise up. You know, I remember when Fallout 3 was coming out, being on the No Mutants forum. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I do, yeah. They are the most sort of neckbeardy of all the neckbeards on this issue. Like, I am fully 100% a Fallout neckbeard myself, but like, you can just smell how sweaty those conversations are when you're on that forum, I swear to God.
But this kind of idea that Fallout is forever ruined now, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's kind of silly in a bad way on the face of it, because like, it is more Bethesda's franchise than it really ever was Black Isle Interplay's. Like, their vision of the series has like defined it for more people, and people who started with Fallout 3, Fallout 4, Fallout 76, like, don't have these sorts of problems necessarily. Like, they're not looking to get these things out of Fallout. Like, it's the difference in like approach between the West Coast narrative focused Fallouts and the East Coast simulational Fallouts. Like, it's a matter of expectations. So like, the Bethesda Fallouts don't always meet my expectations as a player who primarily plays for narrative. Like, I don't often get the same sense of narrative consequence. I don't often get the same sense of like depth of dialogue. But like, similarly, those little simulational moments and those moments of exploration. Like, I mean, nobody does skeleton tableaus like Bethesda, period. Like, they're so good at environmental storytelling. Like, even in the show, they're doing skeleton tableaus. Like, it's awesome. And, like, that, like, they just have different strengths. Like, they're differently balanced games with a, sort of a different philosophy of how the player would or ought to approach them. So, like, the different games could be equally frustrating for a number of different reasons to different people. Like, I don't think that there's any kind of saying that, like, one is necessarily better than the other. It really comes down to personal preference, both as a player and a developer.
And I do think that there's a lot of rose-tinted glasses stuff looking at 1 and 2, and even New Vegas. Like, I would probably pick up 2 and play it again right now, because I've been itching after watching the show, if I didn't have to do the fucking ant tomb right at the beginning.
Yes, again. God. Oh.
Oh, my God. It's mm-hmm. so awful.
But I similarly, I mean, like, it's a barrier for me to restart 3 because you got to spend like an hour in the vault before they let you out of it too. Like, it's a any consequence of having like a very linear, separate introduction that doesn't let you just like fuck off right away is frustrating.
This is one of the reasons that I think 76 is the best Bethesda Fallout. It doesn't screw around, right? Yeah. Just opens the door, kicks you out the vault. Here you go. Go get started. Don't want to go talk to that quest giver? We don't care. Go up north. It's fine. Whatever you want to do. And you're on your own, right?
Yeah, it is purely simulational that way. And like, even like what narrative there is, like with the audio log quests and then the NPC quests that they added with like the Settlers and Brotherhood of Steel expansions, like there's a lot in Fallout 76. Like that thing that the show said, like, thou shalt be sidetracked by bullshit every damn time. Fallout 76 is so good at that, at creating these circumstances where it's like compelling and it is compelling to be like, well, I need lead for bullets, and so I gotta go to this mine, and now I gotta go here. And like, you end up with gameplay and systems driven needs that create exploration incentives in the environment. And there's an incredible cohesion between being motivated to be in the game world and feeling motivated by how interesting the game world is in terms of like layout and like the look of it and the vibe and the aesthetic. Like, it's a really cool place to be. And all of these simulational emergent systems just make it so easy to kind of treadmill within it and just keep going and doing things. Like, there's always something interesting to do.
Yeah, I will always love the colors of post-apocalyptic Appalachia and just cresting a mountain and listening to a song on the radio, and there's the Nuka-Cola plant down below you, kind of shrouded in the trees and the darkness of the jungle. The jungle swamp, and it's just gorgeous. It hits.
I didn't realize either until I went to West Virginia for the project, like how true to West Virginia that is. Like, the West Virginia is one of the most mountainous states that I've ever been in, and not at, like in the way that like Colorado is with the Rocky Mountains, not like big mountains that take all damn day to get up. It's just like so much of the state is just rolling low mountains and valleys, and that's so beautifully captured in the game.
And the 1-to-1 of the Greenbrier is really wild, too.
Crazy!
Yeah.
Weird. Uncanny.
Yes, it is. I got to go, I was there for their launch event, actually. Oh. And they put us all up in the Greenbrier, and then it was very strange to have them. It's like they held the first conference with everybody, all the games journalists and everything, in the congressional bunker in the Senate chambers. So you're in the Senate chambers of the congressional fallout shelter and having like Bethesda walk up to a podium and there's Pip Boys everywhere and like talking to you. It was very surreal.
That's so cool, man. They said like no cameras when I went there. And so like, I didn't do the tour because if I couldn't capture it for the video, like I just didn't have time and I had other stuff that I ought to do. But like, I am such a junkie for like Cold War infrastructure tours. Like it feels like such an amazing secret. And it was a secret for so long. Like that's like, these are places that people are not supposed to go. They're just like so outdated now that it doesn't even matter. Like, there's no secrets left to the Titan II system. We're past that. So fine, have at.
It's all right. We're building new systems all the time. There's new secrets being built, developed every day. Why do you think it, as I'm watching this television show, I was just struck by A, how lucky I was that it exists. But B, that this weird post-apocalyptic CRPG from 1996 has become this billion-dollar franchise that has a Kyle MacLachlan, Walton Goggins television show on Amazon that they spent a lot of money on, judging by the way it looks. And that there are these games that are incredibly successful. Is it like... Did Fallout 4 sell 75 million copies in the first 24 hours after it came out? Some just incredible number, right?
I can't remember the specific number, but it was large, like weirdly large.
What is it about this franchise, do you think, that has caught on and turned it into a cultural phenomenon?
I think it's sort of the axis of familiarity and unfamiliarity. Like, hard sci-fi and high fantasy, like, both have certain genre requirements of being willing to, like, invest in a game world or game cultures that are, like, very different or, like, very tonally specific in some way. But I think, like, the Fallout series is interesting because, like, the 50s stuff feels... like now to a contemporary audience, like very distant and like very alien itself, but it's also like very familiar. Like this is a world of cars and telephones and skyscrapers. And it's very immediately sort of graspable, like what a person is going to be capable of or what the vibe is going to be. Like the Fallout series is very easy to latch onto, but then once you've latched onto it, it has like so many interesting complications and variations in its aesthetic and its tone and sort of like the way the lore is constructed. I think that the barrier, sort of the creative barrier to like being open to the fiction of it, is like lower than like Skyrim would be.
It's interesting. I'm wondering now if high fantasy hits different if you live in Europe, because you are among the ruins of Roman civilization, which is always kind of like a presupposition for a lot of fantasy settings.
Yeah, absolutely. I hadn't been to Europe at all, really, until just last year when I got to go with my wife. And we went to Carcassonne in France, which is one of the biggest sort of medieval walled fortresses still standing. And it just completely blew my mind. Like I had no idea that something so incredibly large and so, I mean, it looked like fantasy to me because I had only ever experienced those things within the context of fantasy. So having it be history instead was just so cool and such a fascinating connection. Like if I was more familiar with that, yeah, I think that I probably would feel like more connected to the fantasy of it. Like, I don't know, like part of what draws me to Fallout is because I love the Southwest so much. Like I love deserts. I love ruins. Like, I'm just goddamn fascinated by American industrial ruins particularly.
Yeah. And it's kind of like Fallout. You get this imagined, you get to imagine a world where the American empire has fallen and you're living in the ruins of it.
Yeah, which is not hard to do.
Which is, oh, but it hits different when you live here, right? Yeah. Okay, let me see. What else do I have here? You have time for a few more? I know we're over time.
Oh, I got all day personally.
Okay. Before I get into some real deep nerd shit, Jason, do you have anything?
Wow. Now I'm wondering how deep you're going to go.
Oh, we're about to get pretty bad.
Wow. Okay. Cause I'm pretty impressed. I thought we were at least had dipped our toe already.
Oh, we have for sure.
No, I guess, it is interesting thinking about European castles and stuff. One thing that really has struck me about them on various trips is they're less interesting than I'd hoped. The magic is in fact not there, you know, and there's even an element of, you know, seen one castle, seen them all.
Such a New Yorker ass observation.
My wife did say the exact same thing to me when I overscheduled us those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, because the tapestries aren't there and all, you know, and there aren't dogs actually feasting on the bones that you're throwing over your shoulder. I mean, most of them are very, very, very much empty, especially the ones that would be more interesting. And the ones that actually have the stuff in them, it's all from the Baroque period and later. So, I mean, you can see what it was like for Louis XIV, but that's not the same thing. You know what I mean? There are no lances, there are no fair maidens or whatever. It's just a lot of people who smelled really bad living in close quarters.
I don't know, that emptiness is part of what draws me to like ruins though. Like the like the deep past is like permanently foreign in a way that like nothing can really surmount. But like the thing that I think Fallout really taps into that like going to a European castle doesn't is because when you go to a European castle, like you're there with other tourists. You're very rarely there like alone with just like the wind and the sound of rattling metal or whatever. But like if you're driving through rural Nevada, like you'll see shit like that on the side of the road and you can just stop and here's an abandoned gas station that has that exact vibe and that exact sound. And there's no one around for 20 miles. Like you haven't seen a car in an hour and you won't for another hour. Like it is like that, the Fallout vibe is like still accessible, like with sort of deep desert American ruins, like because they're not touristy. It's more expensive to tear things down in the desert than to just leave them to rot.
That's such an interesting point. It makes total sense to me. I mean, the only exception for on like my trips that, and this does stick with me like crazy, is I went to the town of Ephesus, which was a Roman town built on a Greek town. And it's actually, there's a letter from Paul to the Ephesians, and it's these particular people. And it's in incredibly good shape. And I was super lucky because I had a badge from the Discovery Company, you know, like Discovery Communications.
Yeah.
And everyone's heard of the Discovery Channel, right? So they actually let me in as it was closed. Just as it was closing, and I got to walk through it by myself. It was, yeah, everyone should do that. Everyone should get a Discovery, you know, channel badge. And everyone should go, you know, places like that. And anyway, I'm just saying, yeah, that feeling is out there. It's totally true.
Kind of reminded of, do you know what the Biltmore is, either one of you?
Right. No, I don't.
It's a enormous Gilded Age mansion in North Carolina. It has been since turned into, it's a Vanderbilt mansion. And it's one of these things where it's a mansion that's the size of like a small city. just enormous. And they give tours of it. But I imagine I went last year. It's very fascinating to go, but having that kind of historical marker turned into almost like an amusement park, you know, it there's something about that where you're kind of shuttled along with all these, with like this giant line of people slowly working your way through it, where it kind of destroys your sense of awe and the sense of history of the place.
Yeah, Hearst Castle is kind of like that. Like they bus you up. And the different tour groups don't really run into each other, but like while you're waiting for the bus, they want you to go and do this like really high production movie of like all these like Hollywood starlets coming in and like, we're going to see William Randolph Hearst. And they're so pleased. And it's just like, it's definitely to get people who are not history people on board with like learning some history about it. But if you are a history person, like it's just very slight and unsatisfying and overly glossy and totally uncritical.
How do you give a Hearst Mansion tour without talking about so many things?
Yep. They don't. They would rather talk about the carpets and this lovely painting. And did you know that Hollywood starlets were here all the time?
Wow, fascinating. now I want to tour the Hearst Mansion. I've never done that. I bet it's beautiful and it is. Weird. anyway, back to Fallout. Okay, so as old school Fallout heads, the last couple episodes of the show were pretty thrilling to me, especially like the last shot. I was watching it by myself late at night, and I made some noises that I'm not proud of excitement upon seeing, like, you know, you get Kyle MacLachlan stepping on his particular kind of skull, and then the camera pans up, you see what he's seeing, and there's that New Vegas skyline.
Yep.
And I hooted in joy.
I did.
Despite myself. but I am wondering, you know, the end of New Vegas is very variable, as we've already kind of discussed. If you're making a TV show, Noah, what do you pick as the canon ending?
Well, I think there's only one of them that's tidy, which would be the house always wins. So if you're going through New Vegas, if you choose an independent courier, that is the most variations that you can possibly have within like a given playthrough. Like every single quest is sort of like up to your determination, like who you pick, like who comes out on top. Like it is impossible to condense down into anything like individually coherent. And then like the NCR plot line would be like kind of thematically pointless now for the show because they destroyed the NCR anyway. Having Caesar's Legion win would be odd.
I can't imagine that he wouldn't have pushed farther west if he hadn't won, right?
Yeah, no, it's impossible to think that like that military expansion like wouldn't have continued. But like furthermore, like Caesar is not the best character in New Vegas, but House is. Like House is a tremendously voiced character that fits in with the setting incredibly well in terms of like both lore and like aesthetic and vibe and intention. They also already introduced House into the TV show in that round table, which like I really love. I really love that whole scene, like how they do it, how they immediately start bickering about their own different awful ideas for what happens in the vault. It just seems pretty clear to me that if they're already establishing House as a character within the show, then House probably ought to thematically be alive when we pivot back there. And then there's only one ending where that happens either, which is the one where you end up as House's Patsy. And if you go through that quest, you solve all of the different faction quest lines in a very predictable way that is exactly the way that House wants them to do. Also, this preserves independent New Vegas from either the NCR or Caesar's Legion. So that still exists as sort of like its own nation state in the geopolitics of Fallout.
So what do you want? What do you want from season two?
More definitive answers, perhaps. Like the only thing that like I kind of disliked about the structure of season one is that it does like the very common, very traditional modern TV show of like kicking the can between the season opener and the season finale. Like if you want to see the things where like the questions get answered and like all of like the really big moments happen, you typically only have to watch episodes 1 and 8 or 1 and 12 or whatever of a given show. And like all that other stuff is good and helps, but it's like the main plot is just not evenly distributed enough throughout the intervening episodes. Like I can't remember who wrote the tweet But there's a tweet that I think about all the time that's like, back in the 70s, if they made a show called Surf Dracula, you would have seen that fucker surfing every damn day. But if you're going to make a modern show about it, it takes till the end of season one before they even give him a surfboard. And like, I, in a certain way, like, I think that the arcs of the three characters needed to happen as slowly as they did. But as far as like my feeling of the momentum of the show, I felt like it just got going on episode 8. Like my investment in the show, like, became greatest at the season finale in a way that I wasn't expecting. Like, I didn't exactly get Surf Dracula'd, but I kind of feel that way a little bit. So, I would like the episodes to be slightly more momentous in season two, but I don't know exactly what that would mean. Like, I don't know where they're going, which makes it hard for me to have an opinion on.
Yeah, it's, like, who knows what Norm's going to do down in Vault 30, is it 31?
Yeah.
Like, who knows what decisions he's going to make? What, there's so many unanswered questions about Cooper's past, that we still get to play around with. And we get to see New Vegas again on television. But like you said, who knows what any of that means or how it'll actually play out.
I like that they're referencing and reinterpreting like previous main quests. Like, I loved that they had the moment where they were like, "Oh, the water chip's broken. Somebody ought to do something about that." Like, that was pretty great.
Yeah, that was one of those moments where it was like, "Oh, they've played the first game."
Yeah. But I also liked in general how sort of like Lucy's plot line is sort of just a loose reinterpretation of like Fallout 3, but not wasting Kyle MacLachlan the way they wasted Liam Neeson in the first one. Like, I loved it when Lucy was talking about the villain. She was like, "But she steals dads. Like, that's her deal." And like, that naivety is like such a huge part of the Fallout 3 thing. And like, I think that they did the missing dad who knows too much thing so much better in the show. But like, it's obviously a riff on Fallout 3. Like, they're taking the general structure of that like main quest line and just mixing it up so that it's sharper and better.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the Fallout 3 version of the Fallout television show would be Lucy arrives in a place and her father has already been there and solved a couple problems and then moved on. And you maybe have to do some cleanup and then move on to the next checkpoint.
I just can't wait for Kyle MacLachlan to say, "I'm so disappointed in you for cutting up that man's ass."
I'd watch Kyle MacLachlan do just about anything, honestly. Yeah. What perfect casting is this kindly father figure that has dark secrets. Just perfect. What do you want from Fallout 5?
Oh, you know, maybe some better dialogue than Fallout 4. That'd be nice.
I don't know, man. How much Starfield have you played?
Enough to be skeptical. Like, I put 60 hours into Starfield and then like set it down, and it's probably going to be another 3 months before I like come back and try to finish it off. Like, but the thing is that like the Point Lookout, not Point Lookout. Yes, thank you God. Why couldn't I remember that? Far Harbor solves within Fallout 4 most of my issues with Fallout 4. Like, Far Harbor as a quest line is designed in a way that's really reminiscent of the West Coast style of doing it, where it's narrative focused. There's a lot of factions at play. There's a lot of personal player involvement in like how the quest line turns out. Like, I felt like the dialogue was of a generally better quality than the main campaign. Like, Fallout 4 is so peculiar to me because like I disagree with a lot of their creative priorities, but then like within the context of this one particular DLC, it's just everything that I wanted out of it. So like, I don't know, like what I want out of Fallout 5, I'm probably not going to get. Like, it's fine that games aren't designed specifically within me, with like me as an individual in mind. Like, that's impossible to do. Like, the Fallout games are too damn big to ever please everybody. But like, the Fallout TV show does make me hopeful for Fallout 5, because it feels so much more sharply thematically focused and so much more broadly cynical than Fallout 4 did. And I think that that cynicism and that darkness is just such a key to making the setting work and feel compelling. And Fallout 4 like lacked a lot of that for me. And so like if the Fallout TV show is already so tonally different and also so popular, then it seems to me that like they're going to possibly take that as a green light to like get darker with it in Fallout 5, which I think would be a positive.
I completely agree. Did you see, there's a great pitch on Twitter that won't get used, but it was just a great tweet. Set the next one in the South, set it in Memphis, Tennessee. Use the Bass Pro Pyramid as like the central piece of the setting, and have it be ruled over by a ghoul that is in like a mask and things that hide his features, and maybe he's the only one that knows that it was a Bass Pro Shop, but now he's turned it into his kingdom.
Man, Memphis would be such a tremendous Fallout location. Like there's so much history for like 50s pop culture, like Sun Studios, and like so much of that era of music that's like used by the Fallout series comes from Memphis, like during that time. Like it would be tremendous. Like I don't know though, like it would be a little strange to me if they did choose a middle of the country location. Like they seem to enjoy to anchor them to like more of an iconic city. Like besides the Bass Pro Pyramid, like I couldn't necessarily tell you what the Memphis skyline looks like. And I think that that's kind of important to them to have something that like people see it and they're like, bam, that's the city.
Yeah, I agree. Especially with the way that Bethesda does things. It's so much about that environmental storytelling. Right. It's
and
so much
I'd have
about
to be worried about what kind of barbecue they would be serving. What would be barbecued?
Hey, they've got a lot of people eating quests in all the Fallouts.
What's the line from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2? I love this town. This town loves prime meat.
You know, I watched that again for the first time in years, like a couple months ago. And I'm from Dallas.
Oh shit.
It's like I was watching it. I was like, I'd forgotten how perfect. There's something like it captures the mood of the city of Dallas so perfectly. Like that Red River, you know, they're there for that Red River Shootout football game. Like that's real. And the city does get that stupid. Like when that happens, as I remember, I would never want to work that week, whatever shitty retail job I happened to be in at the time. So I knew it was just going to be just drunks just walking around yelling at each other, Oklahoma fans and Texas fans getting into altercations. It was always a nightmare. Watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, audience, is what I'm saying. And that's my message to you at the end of this Fallout podcast that we've just done.
Not a bad message. I mean, if there's any moral, that's a good one.
Jason, do you have anything else?
No, except that now I have to lock myself in the basement and watch the damn show, and I have to keep my kid out. That's the problem. I actually was going to sit down and watch it, Matthew, but you warned me about some of the violence. My 10-year-old sounds like not a good idea.
They really lean into it. Like, everything that was so iconic about, like, Fallout 3, when it introduced the bat system with, like, the slow-mo eyeball gushing extravaganza, like they very much translated that vibe into how they do violence in the show.
Yeah, I told him that the first fight scene, somebody gets their head gets a hole blown in their head, and then a gun stuck through the hole, and then just round after round pumped as the body dangles from the barrel of the gun.
Yeah, they sure do.
Noah, where can people find your work?
Just on YouTube primarily. I publish under my own name, so if you just search up Noah Cole Volger Day, that's easy enough.
So you just had a video about Diablo come out. What's next?
Next, I am trying to work on some smaller games because I've also got a horror novel that I've been working on for a long time, so I'm trying to get that done. So the next video I do is probably going to be about a little Pacific Midwest, Pacific Northwest driving simulator called Pacific Drive, where you take a 1980s station wagon through a supernatural sci-fi event as a survival type game. It's great.
It's funny. I'm more than halfway through Roadside Picnic right now. And my goal was I'm going to finish reading that, and then I'm going to pick up Pacific Drive. So, very excited. And I'm excited to see that video.
There's a communist ambition now to rule or wreck us all. With atomic ammunition, they would like to see us fall. Peaceful men of every nation would become as common slaves. We'll prevent that situation, better we shall fill our grave. You will see the lightning flashing, hear atomic thunders roll. When Moscow lies in ashes, God have mercy on your soul. Here's the question, Mr. Stalin, and it's you who must decide. When atomic bomb starts falling, do you have a place to hide? Sam will still be living when the smoke of battle's o'er. He will make a noose to fit you. God will close up heaven's door. You'll come face to face with Satan, see the loved ones who have died. So be sure when bomb starts falling that you have a place to hide. You will see the lightning flashing, hear atomic thunders roll. When Moscow lies in ashes, God have mercy on your soul. Here's the question, Mr. Stalin, and it's you who must decide. When atomic bomb starts falling, do you have a place to hide? Just remember, Mr. Stalin, how we both fought side by side. When Hitler and Mussolini had you whipped and how you cried. Uncle Sammy came to help you, gave you strength, we gave you all. And now your great ambition is to see our nation fall. You will see the lightning flashing, hear atomic thunders roll. When Moscow lies in ashes, God have mercy on your soul. Here's the question, Mr. Stalin, and it's you who must decide. When atomic bomb starts falling,